Tip FM's Tip Today with Fran Curry.
In association with Slattery's of Pecan, Tipperary's main Peugeot dealer. Slattery's Garage Pecan, the name you can trust for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.
Now, broadcaster Gareth O'Callaghan retired from radio some time ago after he was diagnosed with the condition multiple system atrophy. He said he won't allow the condition to define who he is or what he's still capable of achieving in life. Now, he's written a new book. It's called What Matters Now, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Gareth, good morning to you.
Great to talk to you, Fran. How are you?
I'm very well indeed, and lovely to talk to you. I read your book over the weekend, and to be honest with you, I found it heartbreaking in points, and I found it inspirational in other aspects of it as well. But before I talk to you about the book, how are you now? How are you getting on with this condition?
It's different each day. I think now I'm sitting here chatting to you, I actually feel quite good. Whereas 6 hours ago, in the middle of last night, the pain I experience most nights is quite excruciating. So I tend to have to get up, and I tend to have to either put the pillows behind me, or I have to tend to get up and sit in a chair for a short while just to let the pain ease. It's a pain that's called neuropathic pain. So anyone who would have, say, fibromyalgia, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, would be very familiar with that type of pain. But unfortunately, with this condition, multiple system atrophy is similar in many ways to motor neuron disease. It progresses much faster. So the pain tends to be more severe and unpredictable. And I'm trying to balance between taking extremely strong painkillers, which would leave you brain fogged all day and, you know, pretty incapable of, I suppose, conversing with people and remembering things, because the very strong opiate painkillers can cause that kind of brain fog. So I try to kind of find a level where I can tolerate the pain, but I can still have a rational kind of conversation, and I can still drive, and I can still get out and about. So that's really how I am. But I'm feeling good now this morning. I got to the beach yesterday in Inchidani in West Cork, and for me that is almost like a kind of a tonic in itself. I feel great after that.
Well, I'm delighted to hear it. To the book, Gareth, abused as a child, profound depression and anxiety, marriage breakdown, financial issues, and to cap it all, the current diagnosis. Dealing with any one of those would be difficult enough, but to do so alongside the kind of radio career you've had, where you're entertaining people on a daily basis and you have to be bright and breezy and all of that, that must have been exhausting.
Yeah, it was. I suppose when you put them all in the one sentence, you kind of think, wow, that's kind of a sort of bundle of laughs, really, in many respects. So people say, you can't be serious. Did that all really happen to you? And yes, it did. And it happened, I suppose, over a 20-year period. So, you know, when I look back at my childhood, I had a wonderful childhood as a young kid. My parents were the most wonderful parents. I came from a great home. Sadly, I became the victim of a child abuser when I was 11, and that continued, I suppose, in real time for about a year and a half. But then psychologically and emotionally, a lot of the pain and the rejection I felt as a result of that was suppressed, and I didn't realize just for how long I was carrying this inside, and it had huge effects on my life now that I look back. And it wasn't until maybe 15 years ago that I really started to tackle it and try to get rid of that sort of anchor that was hanging around me, that was holding me back. My marriage ended in 2005. This would have been round about the time that the abuse really kind of blew up within me, and I suddenly realized that, no, you haven't dealt with this, and you have to get help, and you have to find out what it is that's causing this to continue to reoccur. And also at that time, financially, I found myself in dire straits. So yeah, you're absolutely right. You have a collection of the most difficult, emotionally oppressive things, and they're sitting in front of you on the table, and you have to try to deal with them. And it took me quite a while. And when I left my job in RT in 2005, I felt I needed to go away and to find out what was going on in my life, because I really do believe round about that time I had some sort of a, I wouldn't call it a nervous breakdown, but it was almost like as if I woke up and I had lost a close, one of my best friends had died that year. My marriage had ended. Financially, I was in dire straits. And I think something just snapped inside, and I said, right, that's it. I've had enough. I can't continue to, I can't continue to be the happy man in the afternoon that I was, because for quite a long time, I was putting it on. I was forcing myself to do this because I had to, because I needed to generate an income. And I think the afternoon show was synonymous with that kind of feel-good factor. Yes. So when suddenly I said, I can't do this anymore, it's just not on, I quickly decided, some people thought I was absolutely insane, but I quickly decided that I had to get away from the intensity of the work, and it was very, very intense.
The way you described young Gareth, who was abused, was just heartbreaking, because it was visual to me. I could see, particularly the little boy on the platform where you escaped from this. It was a brother, wasn't it, who abused you?
Yes, it was. That's right.
Yes.
That's right. It was a brother from a religious order there. Yes. And, you know, unknowns to me in 1972, I went, like so many other young kids at that time, I was a Cub Scout. Between the Cub Scout and Scout generation kind of moved from one to the other, and I went with the local Cub Scout pack to this particular it was run by an order, the Franciscan order, and during the summer they gave over the entire boarding school complex to youth clubs and scout groups and that. So within days of arriving, I was earmarked by one of the individuals, and I was groomed, and you know, he made me feel very important.
Yes.
And anyone I think who has been abused will know what that feels like. But then, unfortunately, very quickly he started to abuse me, and I thought once the abuse had stopped that it would just eventually lift, and you know, almost like as if, you know, a bad cold will eventually lift and you'll feel well again. And it didn't. And as you say, and so many people who have read the book have said to me that that vivid image of the little boy on the platform holding his brown suitcase is something that they will never forget. And I describe how I was working in Galway from about 2006 for about 3 years until I came back to Dublin. And occasionally I would take the train from Galway to Dublin and then back to Galway. And now and again, the Galway train stopped in Clara. And that was that was a memory that I have since I was 12 years of age. My second year, when I was invited back to the college, I was still hiding this awful secret of the abuse. And I remember my father dropped me to the railway station in Dublin. He had no idea what was going on, neither had my mother. I was terrified to tell them because I was threatened by this guy that I would get into all sorts of trouble if I revealed it to anybody. And that 12-year-old boy was carrying a little brown suitcase, and he was met at the station by the abuser. And he, on the third day of his stay, and I kind of use it in the third person, I describe it, because it's a form of dissociation. It's like I'm looking in on this. And it's something I learned over the years, that it's not as painful to relive it and to retell it if you describe it in the third person, as if you're a witness. And on one of those journeys back to Galway, the train stopped in Clara, and it was the first time, Fran, I got out of the train and just stood on the platform. And this probably would have been back in 2007. So it was a long time after the abuse. But Clara railway station hadn't changed at all. It was still the small, picturesque, quaint, old country railway station that it always had been. But as a result of that, it immediately felt exactly as it did back in 1972, 73.
So the fear hit you straight away.
Oh, straight away, it was almost like a click. It was almost like as if something just fired off in my head. And I got back on the train and I sat down. And I always remember I was trying hard not to cry. And I looked out the window and for a moment I saw this little 12-year-old boy holding a brown suitcase watching me go by inside the window of the train. And he followed me to the end of the platform. And it was a kind of a ghostly experience. It was almost like as if I had left that 12-year-old part of me back there, and he was still there. He was still waiting on the platform all these years later.
Even listening to you now describe it, it really does something to me. It's extremely powerful. Another thing that was almost throwaway in some way was when you went back then, you drove down much later, and you climbed over the fence, you went into where this building was. But you said something that, as I say, was almost throwaway. You spat at the building.
Yeah, I did, and I wondered should I include that in the book, and I think I had to because...
It was very powerful.
Yeah, I think it was me reclaiming, you know, myself, and I had a photograph, a colour photograph of the 12-year version of myself, and I brought it with me, and I kind of held it close to my heart, and I walked towards the building, which was in ruin at that stage. That would have been back in 2008. It was actually the Saturday after Barack Obama was elected president of the United States. So maybe it was 2008, or was it 2009? I think it was 2008. It was November. And I stood there and I looked at the building and I looked up at the first floor window where the abuse had taken place, and I just looked at the little boy in the photograph and I held him close and I just spat at the wall of the building. And most people find spitting to be repulsive and revolting, but I just felt I was repulsed by what had happened to this little boy, and it was just an instant reaction I had. And I quickly turned around and I walked away. And I remember it was a misty, rainy morning, and I climbed back over the gate, back into the car, and I drove away again. But there was a sense of healing there that I just could experience very quickly then after that.
So many aspects of the book I could talk to you about, but I suppose I have to mention about your father, because like both your diagnosis and indeed news of your father's condition as well, roughly around the same time that you found out that he had a short time to live.
Yes, he did. And, you know, God bless him, it was his third anniversary yesterday.
Was it indeed?
He would be 93 now, but it was February back in 2018, and I had decided to go to the doctor because so many things had gone wrong, and I was tripping and falling, and I was having all sorts of strange experiences, which I explain in the book. And Paula, my wife, said to me, look, you've got to get this seen to you. You've got to go and get this sorted out. And men are generally not very good at going to the doctor. So in the end, I went, and Michael, my GP, ruled out a stroke, which I had an idea it could have been, it wasn't, he said. And then I said, well, it must be Parkinson's. And he said, no, it's not. He said, it looks like Parkinson's, but I definitely think there's something far more serious and insidious in there behind it. So he said, he sent me to see a neurologist, and we both had an idea that day, the doctor and myself, that we were looking at this strange, rare Parkinsonism. It's almost like Parkinson's the way it starts, but then it veers away on its own horrible mad journey, that we thought it might be multiple system atrophy. So just before I went to work that day, I called in to see my parents, who lived close by my doctors, and I could sense when I sat down at the kitchen table that the two of them had also got some bad news, because my parents were always delighted to see me, and the three of us would sit around before I went to work, and we would spend, I can't remember how many wonderful mornings we would just sit there and drink pots of tea and chat. But that morning there was something wrong, and I explained what had happened to me and that I was very worried that I wasn't very well. And then my mother said, well, I think your dad has something to tell you as well. And he said, we've just come back from the doctor, the same doctor. And we have to wait for the results of a blood test that he has had. So it turned out later that evening that he found out that the blood test was showing traces of cancer and that it was malignant. So he died 8 weeks later. But I'll always remember, and this is why I definitely believe in the afterlife, and I definitely believe that we do go somewhere very, very special. He said to me that morning, he was a great businessman, a real cool head, and he said to me, have you a pension? And this is after getting his own bad news. Yes. And I said, no, I don't think I do, Dad. And he said, you do, because I remember years ago you put money into a pension. And then I think he said, you stopped. I said, I did. I stopped a few years back. He said, well, that money is still there and it's still yours. So find it, because you're going to need it. And I never really gave it any more thought. And sadly, he passed away 8 weeks later. And I had been, my neurologist, Professor Peter Kelly, a wonderful guy from the Mater Hospital, said to me, we're going to bring you into hospital for 2 weeks. We've got to diagnose this and we can't let it roll on. So the morning I was going into hospital, this would have been around about the last week in May, about 6 weeks after my dad died. I was leaving my apartment and Paula said to me, now check your postbox because you won't be back for 2 weeks. And I opened the postbox and there was an A4 envelope inside. And I opened it, and there were all the details of my pension.
Yeah, I got.
Which I had never given a second thought to after he had said this to me back in February. And I hadn't made any phone calls. I didn't even know the pension company that the pension was with. And here were all the details. And there's no explanation other than what I think is that he was looking out for me, and he still is, and I love to believe that that's the way, you know.
Well, I am sure he is indeed. You spoke as well about something that, to be honest with you, myself, I've been trying to put a label on for a long time. You spoke about death anxiety, but you mentioned about the fear of non-existence. And I find that very, very interesting, just that concept.
Yeah, I think everybody, unknowns to themselves, we all have a terrible anxiety about death. Now, most of the time, we don't think about it. We tend to kind of, death is out there somewhere and we don't go near it. The closest it comes to us usually is when someone we know or love passes away. And I think it's because of the finality of death that most of us, even people who say, I don't believe in anything, I don't believe in the afterlife, I don't believe in God, people still cling to the tiniest, flimsiest little hope that there is something there. Because the idea that there's nothing there is almost impossible for the mind to comprehend. And this is why I say it's the concept of nothingness. Nothingness, if you can imagine, the only way I could compare it is to when you are in a deep, deep sleep and you have no recollection that you dreamed or that you were even asleep. There's just nothing. And then you wake up and you know that for the last 4 or 5 hours you have been literally nowhere, fast asleep. And I think this is something that a lot of people fear, that it's the concept of nothingness forever, which is what they call the death anxiety. And it's why many, many people, even when they're coming close to death, who perhaps haven't believed in anything for years, they tend to throw the towel in and they say, I want to talk to a priest, or I want to talk to somebody who can help me to understand this because I'm terrified. And it's something that we need to talk about, we need to think about, because it's only when we overcome this anxiety that we can then truly live a very full life. And one particular incident there recently, I met a wonderful woman who has incurable cancer, and it's cervical cancer, and she knows that she only has a matter of time left. And I received a very long email from her. She had read my book and enclosed her phone number, and I rang her for a chat, and I, you know, she was terrified about this, and she said she was terrified that her husband would meet someone and fall in love with them, and he would forget her, and that her children would grow up and they wouldn't really know her.
Oh, God.
And we chatted for about an hour, and what the conclusion we reached was that, first of all, you can't be thinking beyond the end of life. You have to consume yourself with what's going on in life. In other words, that person you've married, who you married because you loved them, you have to love them as much as you can. And I think the way you do that is that when you get up in the morning, you say to yourself, this is a brand new day. The Navajo Indian tribe in North America, years and years ago, the Navajos used to say to their children, when you wake in the morning and you look at the sun, that's a brand new sun. That's not the sun that was there yesterday. And the people you meet, you're meeting them as if it's for the first time. And when you say goodnight to them that night, you give thanks for the day that you've had, because the joy that that day brought you is all that's truly important in life. We don't know what tomorrow brings. So the thinking behind that is that you live your life to the full within that day. And if you do that, that's where the real joy of life comes from.
That's a beautiful thinking, and I wish we could all embrace that. The heroine of the book has to be Paula. Would you just tell us a little bit about her?
Yes, well, she's at work at the moment, and she's actually listening in to you. She's working in Dell here in Cork. We live in Cork. She's from Cork. I met her and fell in love with her 5 years ago. Almost, I think, instantly. I just thought, this is a woman I want to spend the rest of my life with. And I think, Fran, if I hadn't met her, I don't think I'd be here now, because I think the condition would have accelerated so fast, and the progression would have been so quick, that I think it would have consumed me and taken me. I think Paula was almost sent to me. And I don't mean that in the sense that she was sent to look after me, but she was sent to me so that I could learn about what real love is. And I think we tend to go through life thinking we know what love is and thinking we realize how important it is. But it's only when, I think, you're faced with a huge challenge, and that's when your love is tested. Can you overcome the daunting seriousness of this challenge by continuing to love fully and embracing each day as it comes? And I think that's why the two of us, this is what we do. We don't watch television. We listen to music. We chat. We walk. We head off, you know, in the car here and there when we get a chance to. And I think it's the partnership as well as the love that has made me feel so blessed. She's an extraordinary woman, and definitely, you know, when the mold was being created, I think God definitely only made one of her, because I think people like Paula seem to be very, very rare on the ground, you know.
Well, as I say, she comes across beautifully out of the book. I wish you tremendously well, Gareth. The book, I would recommend it to everybody. It certainly has me thinking, and constantly thinking, in fact, since I wrote it. And obviously, that's why you wrote it, I suppose.
Yeah. I wrote it, Fran, because I think it was almost like a lot of stuff I was carrying around in my head for a long, long time. And I think when the neurologist says to you, this is the way it is, this is progressive, it's incurable, there's nothing we can give you that's going to stop it, there's nothing that will slow it down, and effectively, it is going to kill you. And we can't tell you when that will be, but it is, it's a given, because no one has survived this. And I like to think that maybe I can break the rules there, or at least, you know, bend the prognosis a little bit and prove to them that I can continue to live for a longer time than they think I will. But when you're given news like that, everything falls apart. Everything that you thought was important, career, wealth, trying to make money, you know, where will we go on our holidays next year? Now I say to myself, we have a weekend coming up. Let's plan to go to Inchidani or to Garrettstown Beach or to Currabinny Woods. You know, unfortunately, we can't go beyond the county yet. But I don't want to go on a world cruise. I don't want to climb Mount Everest. I just want to be able to enjoy the little things that I overlooked and took for granted for so long. And I think that was why I read the book, because every single one of us shouldn't have to wait until we get very bad news to really begin to try to learn who each of us is, like to learn who I am.
And that's exactly what I got from the book, Gareth, and thank you for that. It's called What Matters Now. It's in, of course, the usual bookstores aren't open, I suppose, but Easton certainly is open, and they're carrying it, aren't they?
Easton's are open, and I know that many of the popular bookshops locally are doing a mail order service. So what they will do is if you ring the shop, they will actually say, yeah, look, we'll take your details and we can post the book out to you. And it has been very, very effective. And I really, you know, and if I can just appeal to everybody, please, you know, look after our local bookshops because they're really finding it very, very difficult at the moment. And they really, really do need, you know, our loyalty. And so I know that many of the local bookshops there are stocking it, and they'll be delighted to post it out.
Absolutely. Gareth, it was a real pleasure. You look after yourself, and thank you for coming on with us today.
Thank you, Fran, and look after yourself. Great to talk to you.
Bye-bye now. That's broadcaster Gareth O'Callaghan speaking to us today. His book is called What Matters Now, and I would highly recommend it to you indeed. 1800 938 007.
Tip FM's Tip Today with Fran Curry.
In association with Slattery's of Pecan, Tipperary's main Peugeot dealer. Slattery's Garage Pecan, the name you can trust for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.